Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Sheckman. Red or blue or green, whichever side you take in this election. If you're not anxious or nervous, it's probably only because you haven't been paying attention. National elections in particular always make people anxious. After all, it's a gut check, a chance to affirm or reaffirm your deepest held ideas and values and test them against your friends, neighbors, and your country. But in this election, something far deeper has happened. In 8 years, we've gone from talk of hope and change to fear and existential dread as the overriding feeling about the election and about America. My guest, Laura Turner, has written a great story about this. She's a writer and editor based in San Francisco, and it is my pleasure to welcome Laura Turner to Radio Who, What, Why. Laura, thanks so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
As we look at the anxiety that is sort of free-floating out there and all the people that you talk to in the course of reporting this story, is the story, in your view, about this election or the election merely as a reflection of a whole lot of other profound changes taking place that this election somehow becomes the code for?
That's a great question, and I think it has to be both. I mean, there are a number of sort of free-floating issues that have risen to the surface as a result of the rhetoric of this election. But again, the election has really been the thing that has brought them to the surface, and I think a lot of folks have felt permission to express thoughts and feelings that perhaps they wouldn't have expressed without Donald Trump running for office. So there have been people who have said things that are more racially motivated than they would have felt comfortable expressing in public because they see him doing that same thing. So it's very much tied together, but as the article talks about, there's a history of this sort of national anxiety taking over at times of uncertainty in America.
One of the things that you point out is the degree to which a similar kind of anxiety was pervasive back shortly after the turn of the last century. People felt powerless as a whole wave of changes, including industrialization and steam power and the expansion of the printing press, that all of that produced a similar kind of result.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this great book that I cite called American Nervousness, 1903, by a writer named Tom Lutz. And he makes the case that there was this pervasive sense of dread around that time, which was a condition that psychologists called neurasthenia, this sort of free-floating anxiety about the future that attached itself to particular issues. And there were a number of cases of this particular affliction that Lutz cites in his book. And it was interesting because it was dealt with very differently if you are a man or if you are a woman. So if you're a man, you were told, well, you need to see out in nature, you need to go for hikes, you need to be outside and sort of restore your nervous energy. And as a woman, you were put to bed and occasionally actually spoon-fed a diet of milk by a nurse to kind of remind you of your total dependency on other people. So, you know, again, this is a time now when we see responses breaking down along gender lines. Women who have gone through sexual assault have really had to kind of relive their experiences in ways they didn't choose to because of the tenor of this election. And men at times are more free to be sort of exempt from those conversations. So it's really interesting to see the parallels.
It's interesting to look at the parallels and realize that given the anxiety that existed at that point, back at the turn of the last century, how much more intense it is this time, fed by things like 24-hour news and social media and all the instant communications that come at us today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can't discount the strong intensifying effect that having the news constantly at our fingertips has on us. And it can feel helpful on the one hand to know that we are always, you know, one click away from learning what's going on. But on the other hand, we are always one click away from growing more and more anxious because there's nothing stopping us from learning what's happening. There's no waiting for the morning newspaper. Now it's just all, you know, there in our phones. And so that does really kind of distill the anxiety into a very pure and pervasive form in a way that it simply couldn't have 100 years ago.
One of the other things you point out is the way in which we react emotionally to our perception of what's going on, regardless of what the underlying facts might be.
Yeah, and it comes back to this whole idea that perception is reality. So, you know, you see people who are sort of constantly checking the polls and refreshing Nate Silver's blog to find out what is going to happen. And it seems that, you know, we really should be able to recognize that the facts are uncertain right now, but are leaning in a particular direction. Hillary's had sort of a, you know, not insignificant lead in the number of polls, but our feeling of fear can get so great that that dictates our reaction to reality. We think that the worst possible outcome may happen, and we want to be prepared for it. And in some senses, this is, you know, almost like an evolutionarily helpful trait. We want to assume the worst and prepare for that so that we can survive in any given situation. But that does have the effect of creating a ton of anxiety in us. And one of the best antidotes to anxiety is to look at, okay, what are the facts? What am I actually dealing with?
Is there reason to believe, and I want to come back to something you said earlier, is there reason to believe, because so much of this has been said, so much has been talked about in this national dialogue that we've been undergoing for the past year, year and a half, that at the end of the process, that perhaps it has a cathartic effect? Is there any historical reason to think that might be the case?
You know, that's a really good question, and I'm not sure about that, just because so much of what I've read about in the past wasn't necessarily related to one particular election. This election is quite unique in that sense, but was more of a culturally sort of in the air kind of feeling that did go away with time. If I were to opine on this, I would say that there is something cathartic just nationally about, you know, exercising our fears and sort of saying this is what I'm afraid of, and then coming to realize that it didn't come to pass, or it did, and that's, you know, scary, but also cathartic in its own way. So I think there is an emotional buildup, right? And that emotional buildup has to go somewhere at a certain point. It can't just hang in the ether forever. But I think we'll know a lot more about that in a couple of days. It'll be interesting to see, you know, come the election, what the general sort of sense of anxiety is at that point.
I guess what really needs to happen is somebody needs to take a survey, not a polling survey of pharmacies, and find out if there's been an increase in the amount of anti-anxiety medication prescribed.
Totally. No, I said a couple of the people that I spoke with have actually gone on medications like Ativan to deal with their increased anxiety. So, you know, anecdotally, I can tell you that there are some people who are turning to that at this point in time.
One of the things that drives that, something else, you quote somebody in your piece as saying that one of the anxiety-producing aspects is waking up every morning and not knowing what comes next, not knowing what they're going to hear or read that day. Talk a little bit about what you heard in your reporting on that.
Yeah, there were a number of folks who said they would wake up in the morning worried about what was coming that day. And I think this is particularly intensified as both campaigns have been trying to sort of dig and reveal more about each other and kind of smear each other, where you don't know what's coming that's going to be unsurfaced. And so again, like I mentioned, some of the women that I spoke with were survivors of sexual assault, and they would feel particularly anxious at the idea that they would wake up and hear on the news everywhere around them another story about a woman who had been assaulted, groped, what have you. And kind of, you know, that makes them have to sort of relive what they went through. And that can be particularly traumatizing. And then some of the women I spoke with who were people of color talking about feeling unwelcome in this country, feeling afraid that someone would say something derogatory to them in public. As you know, one of the sources that I cited was the Southern Poverty Law Center did a study on schools and what kids were saying to other kids to sort of parrot what they had heard their parents saying at home, and would do this kind of xenophobic, racist rhetoric at school. And these are young kids we're talking about who were afraid to get up in the morning and go back to their classroom and faced kids who told them to go back to Mexico or that they weren't welcome here because they're Muslims. So there's a very real sense of uncertainty just about what's happening that day that's very difficult.
And this really gets to the heart of one of the things you talk about, this nexus between people's personal fears and the way in which all of this has become part of the national dialogue and the kind of feedback loop that it creates.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of my interest is I'm someone who's dealt with anxiety my whole life, and I noticed my personal anxiety ratcheting up the last few months and stopped to wonder, what is that about? Because things are generally okay in my life. And so starting to realize that I was actually feeling personally anxious about this election was kind of the germ for this article. But there is this feedback loop where we can feel very anxious as people, and then we turn on the news and read something about the election that makes us feel more anxious, and then that increases our anxiety, and we want to know more, so we watch more or read more or tweet more, and then that makes us feel more anxious. So it is this feedback loop that encourages anxiety. And in part, it can be wanting to be engaged, wanting to read, wanting to be informed, which a lot of these people I spoke with are. So they value the process of learning a lot about, you know, what is the election? What are the candidates' positions? What are the policies that I'm voting for? But it's hard to simply read about that without also reading about the very, very, heightened racism, misogyny, just the kind of ugly tenor of this campaign. And that feedback loop perpetuates itself.
And how does that play out against people's concern for personal safety?
And that is a good question. I didn't end up getting to tell this story in the article just because I interviewed so many people, but there was a woman I spoke with who talked about being on a bus, and she's African-American, and there was a man on the bus with her who started kind of looming over her, getting very close into her personal space, and then told her that she should go home, even though she was from America, and that she wasn't welcome here. And that is, you know, one example of the kind of sense of invasion of space, an invasion of autonomy, really, that can affect people's own fears for their safety and make them feel like they're not safe when they go out. So I think in some ways, this election has had the effect of reinforcing people's sort of personal boundaries and bubbles and telling them that they should stay with the people they know, that they should be safe and not necessarily try to risk getting to know new people or entering into different spaces, because if they do something even as simple as riding the bus to work, they may not be able to do that undisturbed. And that's, a disturbing thing.
When you look at the historical examples, particularly the kind of nervousness that we were talking about earlier that happened at the turn of the last century, how long did those cycles last? What did we learn about that?
Mm-hmm. They were generally, I would say, a couple of years in length. The book that I cited talks just about 1903, but on either side of that, there were very important factors that contributed to this sense of anxiety. And I would say that there's, when there is a lot of uncertainty about the future in our country, we tend to grow anxious. And right now we are in a time when the uncertainty looms large ahead of us and is also, there are high stakes. So there's a period of a couple of years. And I think that even with the election, this isn't something that's going to just end or go away. The people who are deeply partisan on both sides are, one half of them are going to feel very disappointed and angry, and the other half will be happy, but also feel free not to listen to their kind of counterparts. So I think there will be a very real sense for a while of a divided country, and with the way that sort of Trump's candidacy has changed the GOP, I think there's a lot of fear of the future, even if he does not win the election. So there are a number of different ways that I think I can see this kind of continuing on into the future for quite some time.
One of the other things that seems to feed this, and I think that it's a natural aspect of reporting on the election, is that the degree to which the analysis and the polls, which are so much a part of the coverage today, breaks us down into such very specific divergent groups. And that the more coverage there is on those specific groups and the differences in how they're reacting, the more that emphasizes the sense of national divide.
Absolutely. It's almost like people retreating to their corners, and you get in a little bit of an echo chamber. And you see this on things like social media when people post their opinions and share things on Facebook, say that they, you know, hope will convince people to think differently, and how really fruitless that tends to be. I have never met anyone who has said, yeah, it really changed my mind on this issue because someone posted a very thoughtful Facebook update about it. That just doesn't tend to happen. But we think that we can convince and change the people around us by sharing our opinions, because that's what we can control. That's what we can share. And we kind of hope that the people we love and know will agree with us. And when they don't, the tendency isn't to engage in respectful dialogue. The tendency is to retreat to our corners and say, you know, well, you believe this, so I don't want to talk to you, or I think badly of you. And that really breaks down conversation.
I guess we'll reach the maximum level of fright or flight on Tuesday morning.
Absolutely. It'll be interesting to see.
Laura Turner, her recent article is When National Turmoil Becomes Personal Anxiety. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on Radio Who, What, Why.
Thanks for having me. It was good to talk with you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.